Welcome to Military History Inside Out, a podcast devoted to the study of how war has been waged across the centuries. In today's podcast of Military History Inside Out, I interview Dr. Mel D'Ailey about his new book, Always at War, Organizational Culture in Strategic Air Command, 1946-62. He talks about how Strategic Air Command was formed and led by General LeMay, how it developed, how it was a successful strategic deterrent force, deterrent nuclear force. And Dr. D'Ailey ends the interview by talking about his personal 44.3-hour record-breaking bombing mission after 9/11. So I hope you enjoy the interview. Thank you. All right. I'm speaking with Dr. Mel D'Ailey, author of Always at War, Organizational Culture in Strategic Air Command, 1946-62. Thank you for speaking with me.
Hi, Chris. I appreciate you taking the time to give me this interview.
Thank you. So tell me about your background in writing and in history.
So I started writing in history in 2007, and actually before that, through some other academic programs. I'm a retired Air Force pilot. I served 26 years in the Air Force, and about two-thirds of the way through my career, the Air Force started me on an academic track. They sent me to one master's program at Command and General Staff College, where I did a master's thesis on Posse Comitatus. And then from there, they sent me to the MacArthur Air Force Base, to the School of Advanced Air and Space Studies, which is another Air Force master's program. And there I did a thesis on low-yield nuclear weapons. And from that program, the Air Force said, we'd like to go and get a PhD. So they sent me to the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, the place I considered to have the best basketball program in North Carolina. We don't mention that other school 8 miles down the road. But so there I studied under Dr. Dick Cone and did my dissertation on Strategic Air Command and its organizational culture, which is the foundation for this book. And I started in 2004 and graduated in 2007. And then from there, I went back into what you would consider to be a regular Air Force career, staff work, et cetera, and continued to revise the manuscript and do research and published an article out of the book and some other articles on nuclear deterrence and nuclear proliferation, which is one of the fields I teach in my primary job.
And so my next question is usually, have you always wanted to write a book on this subject? And it sounds like your career was sort of geared in that direction to end up writing.
So I joined the Air Force in 1984. I reported to the Air Force Academy. And in 1988, I graduated from the Air Force Academy and went to pilot training. And when I graduated in 1989 from pilot training, I was given my assignment to a B-52 Stratofortress. And then I became a member of Strategic Air Command. So I went to initial B-52 training. And from initial B-52 training, I went to Barksdale Air Force Base in Louisiana, where I had my first assignment as a B-52 co-pilot. All of that to say that the real reason for the book was when I joined Strategic Air Command in 1989, and it went away in 1992, 3 years later, everybody said, hey, you guys in SAC, Strategic Air Command, always operate a little bit differently than the rest of us. And, you know, when I had the opportunity to do research, my goal for the research was to say, why is it that everybody views SAC differently? And so that became the basis for the book.
All right, so tell me a little bit about the book and its focus.
So I will say that when I did the research for the book, the idea was to try to say why was Strategic Air Command just a little bit different in terms of its organizational culture. What made it unique, what made it not better or worse than any of the other commands, but what made it unique in terms of the Air Force and what was its impact on the overall Air Force. So when I started the research, I didn't expect it to go this deep, but a lot of the things that you find out about Strategic Air Command originated with Curtis LeMay. Mm-hmm. Now, that's may not be surprising to a lot of people, because whenever you say the word Strategic Air Command, they think automatically of Curtis LeMay. But he was in a position, having taken over in October of 1948, to stay in Strategic Air Command as the commander till June of 1957. So he was almost there for 9 years, 8 3/4 years, I guess you could say. But he was there for 9 years, almost, and if you give anybody a command for 9 years, they're going to have a ability to shape and mold that command. So, and a lot of the things that he initially did in Strategic Air Command actually trace their roots back to his days as a bomber commander in World War II, both in Europe and in the Pacific. So a lot of the things that he initially did in Strategic Air Command found their foundation in what he did during the World War II campaigns. And then I'll say the other part is how do you build a deterrent force? So General LeMay's charge was to build up a force of strategic bombers armed with atomic weapons that would keep the Soviet Union deterred from marching across Europe. And so how do you do that? And so his idea was threefold. Realistic training. If you're a bomber crew and your mission to the Soviet Union and back is supposed to be 20 hours, well, guess how long your training mission was? Mm-hmm. It was 20 hours. If you're stationed at Minot Air Force Base, as I was in my second tour in the B-52, General LeMay wasn't going to have you generate in the summertime when the snow's melted and everything's nice. He was going to have you generate in the winter, because why do it when it's easiest? But I know if you can do it when it's the hardest, then I know you can do it when it's the easiest. So in other words, we generate Minot when it's January and it's minus 38 ambient, minus 104 wind chill. So that's his idea of realistic training. The second aspect I will say of building a deterrent force was no notice inspections. How do you build a force that you want to keep the other guy at bay, but at the same token, you really don't want to use that force, but you want to make the other guy believe you're going to use that force. And you want that force to believe that they are at war every day, and that was the basis for the title of the book. In General May, when he took over the command, he said, we are no longer preparing for war, but we are at war. And how do you do that? One of the aspects was with no notice inspection. Always making people believe that they could be evaluated at any time. He was famous for flying around the United States, canceling flight plans and landing at bases unannounced. And wing commanders would come out to greet the general, and he would say, execute your war plan, and the fate of that wing commander and that base relied on whether or not they executed their war plan in accordance with what they were supposed to do. And the third aspect I will say is competition. So he was really big on this idea of iron sharpening iron. In other words, how do I keep people at a razor's edge and honed when they're really not seeing the other guy that they're fighting? And so, well, they compete against one another. Outside of his headquarters at Strategic Air Command, he had a totem pole. And on that totem pole was every wing under his command, ranked order from the top to the bottom. Mm-hmm. And you can imagine if you're the wing commander whose wing is on the bottom of that totem pole, what you're going to do with your troops, with your airmen, to get them up off the bottom of that totem pole.
Right.
And so that was his other aspect, and he used bomb competitions as another way to kind of pit people against one another, just to say, this is a way you build a force in being, is through, you know, realistic training, no notice inspections, and competition.
What was the incentive for, I understand why someone might join the Air Force, you know, to be a pilot, but what was the incentive to join such a rigorous force as Strategic Air Command?
I don't know. I'll say people join. I will say more than likely people, once they became part of SAC, there was a lot of incentives to stay in SAC. During the 50s and 70s, it was really a time when the bomber generals were in charge of the Air Force. I think the last bomber general, and I don't quote me on this, but I think the last bomber general who took over as the chief was towards the end of the 1970s, beginning of the 1980s. And then you have what another person wrote, a book called The Rise of the Fighter General, which has been the trend in the Air Force since that time period. But in the 50s, 60s, 70s, it was bomber generals that led the Air Force. Mm-hmm. And so once you got into SAC, you didn't tend to leave because that would be a path towards higher command. And General May was famous for the fact that when he was the chief, he had put other SAC generals in charge of other commands, whether it was Tactical Air Command or Military Airlift Command. So he kind of spread his SAC generals around. So once somebody joined SAC, they knew that their path to higher leadership went through Strategic Air Command. The other thing is there was a lot, General May was not big on professional military education. That's not to say that it, and I'm in professional military education, and I think it's vital, but at the time, General May didn't think it was, you know, necessary. He thought it was necessary to fly planes and to, you know, take on the enemy with a deterrent force. So people in SAC tended to stay in the cockpit more and advance that way than they did, you know, going out and getting career broadening opportunities. Mm-hmm. So I think that's the reason why most people stay in Strategic Air Command, is because it was doing deterrent, and they also knew that it was a way to leadership within the Air Force.
So I noticed, so it was established in 1946, which I guess was about a year or two before the general reorganization of the military, I guess in 47 or 48, I forget. Is that correct?
So the Strategic Air Command was stood up in 1946, before it became an independent service in 47, and with its primary mission being to really do independent strategic bombing. So if you go back to World War II, there was this idea that we formed the 20th Air Force, and it was headquartered out of Washington, D.C., but ran in the Pacific by a commander. Technically, you know, Hap Arnold was in charge of 20th Air Force in the Pacific. And so the idea was to keep those bombers as independent strategic assets and not to be touched by theater commanders. And so when the war ended, they said we liked the idea of what 20th Air Force was, a command devoted to independent strategic bombing. So they created Strategic Air Command, really with the idea of being just a command focused on independent strategic bombing. When General LeMay takes over in 48, he takes the idea of, if we're going to do this thing called deterrence, and we're going to go after the enemy, then he wanted what he called the atomic air offensive. In other words, he brings in more nuclear weapons into the plan, because he's basically saying, we don't bomb the same target once. If a nuclear will do it, go to the target once and take care of the target. So nuclear weapons and Strategic Air Command become more associated, or atomic weapons become more associated with SAC under General LeMay.
Considering your book covers a 16-year period from 46 to 62, I'm curious how much did they have to worry about what the adversary, what the Soviet Union was doing to counter them, or were they able to, you know, were these, you know, what was that dynamic like?
So it influenced the way the Strategic Air Command did operations. So, for example, in the Korean War, General LeMay was reluctant and didn't send the best assets to the Korean War. The reason being is because they always believed that there was going to be another fight with the Soviet Union, and he was afraid that if you send assets to the Korean War that are your best planes with your best capabilities, then the Russians are going to learn what we have, and when we actually have to fight them for real, they will have gained an advantage, having known what we have. So in the Korean War, he pulls back some of his best assets. He doesn't send the best equipment forward. And that kind of says, you know, we don't want to show the Soviet Union what we have because we believe this big fight is coming further down the road. And so it does, you know, influence the way that they do current operations, trying not to show the Soviet Union, again, all the capabilities of the bomber force. The other thing is that there was a belief in Strategic Air Command, right, that there was a fifth column in the United States that if we ever went to war with the Soviet Union, that they would rise up in the United States and try to do sabotage and other things to our national assets.
Mm-hmm.
Because of that, General LeMay developed red teams. In other words, he had people within Strategic Air Command, airmen, who would go out and test base security. They would try to get on base with a picture of a baboon on their ID card just to see if the guard gate was actually checking IDs. Or they would try to penetrate the base as vendors stocking, you know, soda machines. There's a couple of apocryphal stories that come out of that. One that was in a Reader's Digest article where General LeMay, one of these guys got close to General LeMay, and General LeMay held him at gunpoint. Now, I think some of those are apocryphal stories, but it just illustrates the myth of General LeMay. Right? And then there's another story of, you know, a guy who tried to cross a lake at, in Carswell Air Force Base, and he got shot at by the guard. And, you know, he was like, yeah, you guys passed, because he turns around and he swims back to shore. But these are ways that General LeMay wanted to test the base, because they really did believe that there was a fifth column in the United States that would rise up if we ever went to war with the Soviet Union.
When Sputnik went up, I know there was a, you know, a fear that satellites, you know, at the time, a new technology would be used to carry nuclear weapons. How did that affect sort of the Strategic Air Command's mission?
So one of the things when you talk to people and you talk, say, Strategic Air Command, words that are commonly associated with Strategic Air Command are Curtis LeMay, nuclear weapons, and alert. So alert is one of those concepts that a lot of people associate with Strategic Air Command, but people do not realize that FACT never pulled a day of alert under General LeMay. General LeMay leaves in June of 1957. Thomas Power takes over. General Thomas Power takes over, and FACT actually pulls its first alert under Thomas Power. Interestingly enough, Sputnik went up on 4 October 1957, but SAC was pulling alert on 1 October 1957, 3 days before Sputnik went up. Now, was that just because of the fact that it was the beginning of the fiscal year? Did we have knowledge of Sputnik? There's no declassified information that tells us why SAC was on alert before Sputnik went up.
Hmm.
Another thing that Sputnik did was it changed the arrangement with respect to nuclear weapons. So when Harry Truman sees Hiroshima and Nagasaki, he says these weapons are not intended to be the hands of the military. And he takes the weapons out of the hands of the military, and he creates the Atomic Energy Commission, which now has storage sites where if you're going to generate your bomber, you're going to fly to one of these sites. And you're going to get the special material that goes into the weapon that creates an atomic weapon. And so when we go to an alert configuration, when we're saying now we have to have these planes off of the ground within 15 minutes, President Eisenhower says, well, we've got to give custody of the weapons back to the military. So that's another thing that happens because of Sputnik. So the weapons, custody of the weapons under President Eisenhower gets transferred back to the military. And one of the reasons Eisenhower was comfortable doing this, he was a general himself, obviously, and he trusted his military officers, and he said, we can give these weapons, custody of these weapons, back to the military because they need to be ready to go at a moment's notice now that we're in the ICBM age.
Why do you go up to the year 1962? I read some in one of your reviews that someone called that the peak of SAC.
So 1962 is when there's several things that happened in 1962 that caused it to be what I would say the end of the first era of SAC. First of all, the Cuban Missile Crisis happens, and that's really when you see if what General LeMay and Thomas Power, but primarily General LeMay, if this concept of building a force in being that can do all of these things in terms of deterrence, how they execute it, and it, you know, Cuban Missile Crisis obviously ends peacefully, but you see all of the capability of SAC brought to bear. And so that's one of the things is after 1948 LeMay takes over, so after 14 years of training, under Curtis LeMay and Thomas Power, is SAC, you know, a credible deterrent? And the answer was yes. The second thing is that it's at the height where, I say the height, but it's when SAC reached the maximum number of people. So there were about 262,000 people in SAC by the end of 1962. So this, if you were to compare it to today's Air Force, right, which is 330,000 roughly people, you're talking about a force that two out of every three airmen in the Air Force today would have been a member of SAC. That's a big contingent to be, you know, part of the Air Force. And the third thing is that really it's the last year that we get a bomber off the production line. So the, after 1962, we do not make another manned bomber until the B-1 comes online in the Reagan era. So it's the last year that we produce a manned bomber because of the fact that we went from the assured destruction doctrine or the primarily a nuclear doctrine to massive retaliation, as Eisenhower would have termed it. We go through assured destruction. I should say assured destruction. Massive retaliation is what Eisenhower had. We go from massive retaliation into the Kennedy era, where you start to see what we now call flexible response, which is this idea of having a, not necessarily just an all or nothing, either a peace or a Holocaust mentality, but flexible response says there's a range of operations from low intensity conflict all the way up to global thermonuclear war. So because of flexible response, more money and emphasis is actually given to conventional forces as we start to get involved in Vietnam. And the prestige of SAC, the money that goes to SAC, starts to wane. So that 1962 is like the height. And then after that, the Kennedy switch to flexible response, there's Vietnam, et cetera. And so SAC's prestige starts to decline, I would say, after 1962.
So I saw that SAC, if I'm correct, had control of two legs of the triad. I'm curious if that's, you know, having control of two of them seems pretty significant. So I'm curious about that, you know, why that was done.
So General LeMay, long back before he even became the SAC commander, recognized the importance of missiles. And so he wanted the Air Force to have missiles. Now, it wasn't a full buy-in because he and Thomas Power both had, I would say, misgivings about missiles. In other words, if you were a SAC bomber pilot, right, your mission is, hey, my takeoff time is 0600, wheels are rolling at 5:59 and 30 seconds so that I can meet the boss's takeoff time. If you were a bombardier and you were in SAC, and you missed your target, you may be required to fly all the way to SAC headquarters in Omaha and tell General LeMay why you missed your target. So precision, timing, efficiency were all part of being in the SAC mentality. Mm-hmm. When missiles come on board, they don't perform as well. They're not, you know, when General LeMay would show up for a launch, it's like, hey, we're not going to go today, boss. We got a problem with the missile. Or when the first missile comes off the rail, it's like it misses its target by, you know, 5,000 feet. And so General May says, these guys need to be trained in the SAC way. So he kind of puts pilots and navigators in charge of the missileers who are coming into the Air Force to do what we quote-unquote to SAC-emcise them, right, to get them into the SAC way. In terms of the triad itself, there's never really a time where all of the operations. So SAC was, let's back up. So SAC was what we would call a specified command. Mm-hmm. In other words, the sole service command. And General Lee, to put it in today's terms, we have Air Force Global Strike Command. So Air Force Global Strike Command is primary mission is to organize, train, and equip forces, who will then provide them to Strategic Command, based in Omaha, Nebraska, who is a warfighter. In General LeMay's day, that was not the arrangement. He was the person who would organize, train, and equip, and then he was the person who would take those forces to war when called upon, which is another reason why SAC became so big. General LeMay went to the Air Force and said, if you want me to execute this war plan, then I need everything in Strategic Air Command to do it. So they said, we'll give you reconnaissance aircraft. When SAC went away in 1992, U-2s and SR-71s were part of Strategic Air Command. He got the tankers under Strategic Air Command because he says, I've got to get to the target. So air refuelers became part of Strategic Air Command. Obviously, bombers were part of Strategic Air Command. But interestingly enough, Weather Command became part of Strategic Air Command because General May was like, I need to know where the weather is 24-7 or global operation. So at its height, SAC had a bigger balance sheet than even General Motors. I mean, that's how big the organization had become. He got two legs of the triad, fought for and got them, and then under the Joint Strategic Target Planning Staff were the people who put together the plan to deconflict all of the nuclear weapons that would be going off if there was a time of war. Under that, they could integrate the ICBMs. The submarine launch ballistic missiles, the SLBMs. The SLBMs don't technically belong to General May at any time. It's just under this Joint Strategic Target Planning Staff that the plan comes together as to how the missiles, the submarine-based missiles, the land-based missiles, and the bombers, the three legs of the triad, will execute the war plan and deconflict.
I'm not sure if you touch on this in the book, but I've heard that in senior Air Force senior leadership, religion has been big. And I'm wondering, with the awesome power that these guys had, you know, to basically, you know, mutually assured destruction, did you get at all into how much religion played into, you know, these officers' willingness to do this?
I'll be honest, there's really no research that I did that indicated whether or not morality factored into the decision. I will say that General May was very big on what we call predictability and standard operating procedures.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, his thing was, in World War II, his idea was if you were a T-17 crew, you could be, you know, as big as a football team, you are on the field, right, 11 men. Everybody needs to know what everybody else is doing at every phase of the flight. So he built standard operating procedures for his bomber crews, and that carried over to Strategic Air Command. And one of the ideas was, I need people to be predictable. If I tell you to execute your war plan, you're going to execute it. You're not going to question why. If I tell you to turn a key, you're a missileer, you're going to turn a key. You're not there to question why. And so his idea was to emphasize to people how important the mission was. He wanted to make sure people knew why they were there, how important the mission was, and that there would never be any question as to what they were supposed to do. So didn't find any research where people personally struggled morally with whether or not they're going to turn a key or drop a nuclear weapon. From LeMay's standpoint, it was, if I give you an order, I expect you to execute.
Yeah, I read Paul Tibbetts' memoir not too long ago, and he was sort of the same mind. It was like, get the mission done, you know, just do it right.
If you read other authors, like, for example, Peter Thiever in Guarding the Guardian, he'll say that most generals, before they gave that order, would have a heads up from senior leadership that the order was coming and that they would, that they would expect it. In other words, there would not be this bolt out of the blue where everybody would be like, oh, we got to turn keys, let's turn keys. That there would be some kind of warning or, heads up that, hey, we're giving this order. It's about to come down. Not that one day you wake up and the president has told you to execute due to the war and you're like, out of the blue, why are we doing this, right? So Peter does give some indications or hints to the idea that, generals would know that this message is coming before it actually be given.
So what resources did you use to do the research for this book?
A lot of the research that I did for the book came from, I'll say, three sources. The Air Force has a great historical research agency at Maxwell Air Force Base. And in there you can find operational records, you can find oral interviews. A lot of generals who exited the Air Force did a final oral interview before they exited. So a lot of the famous generals, General Thordy, General LeMay, General Carlton, General David Clark, these people all sat down and did an oral interview before they left the Air Force. So that gave you some idea of what it was like to be in Strategic Air Command from the leadership aspect. To get to the administrative side and to figure out what the Air Force and Strategic Air Command was doing, went to the National Archives, the ones that are in Maryland, which is where all of the, you know, administrative and historical records for the Air Force are. So those were the two primary sources. Before he passed, I had an opportunity to sit down with General Doherty himself, and do an oral interview. And it was, you know, just enlightening to see what his aspect was as a former SAC commander and somebody who had served under General LeMay. In addition to that, I went to several of the SAC reunions. So there's a B-47 association, there's a SAC Airborne Control Association, there's a SAC B-52 association, a SAC Missileers Association, and then there was just a general, like, SAC reunion. And so the timing works out, they're held in even years, the timing worked out that in 2006, I was able to go to a lot of these reunions and just say, okay, this is what the leadership was saying, what did you guys at the force level, you know, think about serving as Strategic Air Command? And it was interesting to get their perspective because, to a T, most people who served in SAC in the 50s and 60s were like, we were out there to prevent the Soviet Union from, you know, coming across Western Europe or from attacking the United States. They believed that their mission was important. They believed what General LeMay was telling them, and they were like, we, you know, we were there to be warriors that General LeMay wanted. And so it was good to get that perspective as well, right? To get the, not just the leadership perspective on what the leadership was trying to do, but also to see if it actually translated into what the crew force was seeing.
Did you come across any historical objects, like equipment or something that you hadn't seen before that was particularly interesting?
I will say this. I didn't understand. So I'm a SAC warrior, right? I will say that not so much the equipment, but just the origins of some things that today that we see on Air Force bases throughout the world that we don't understand the origins of. So when I was at the Air Force Academy, I went through survival training going into my second year at the Air Force Academy as a 3-3. I didn't know what the origins of survival training were. And really, survival training was started under General LeMay. He was someone who said, hey, my forces are going to be the ones going downtown at the top cow. My forces are going to be the ones that are going to get shot down in radioactive areas. My forces need to be trained and able to survive in this, you know, atomic environment. So I want my guys to go through survival training. So there's a picture in the book of General LeMay himself going through water survival training. So the idea of survival training that today we do throughout the Air Force actually originated in SAC. Some other things that I would say, like equipment-wise, but just interesting things that you can find on Air Force bases today, auto hobby shops. On most Air Force bases, there's a place where you can take your car and work on it, change the oil, change the tires, etc. These were started under General LeMay, who was a auto hobby enthusiast. He loved to work on cars. There's a picture in the book of him working on his own car, but one of the things that he did was he and one of his vice commanders put a jet engine in the back of a sports car just to see if they could, right? So he starts auto hobby shops on SAC bases, and now today you can find them on most Air Force bases. Another aspect of SAC culture that you'll find on most bases today is aero clubs. General LeMay thought, hey, after flying a 20-hour mission, what will my pilots want to do? They'd want to go fly some more, right? But he does start aero clubs on all of his SAC bases. And then the last thing is he was an enthusiast for shooting traps or hunting. There's a couple pictures in the book of him doing some trap shooting. And he starts Rod and Gun Clubs, which are still in existence on some Air Force bases today.
Mm-hmm.
And then the last thing I'll say that a lot of people don't realize that they'll find on their Air Force bases today is the dorm system. When the Air Force takes over all of these Army bases that they were at, right, when they became a separate turret, a lot of the barracks, or a lot of the places where people live were barracks, right? Open bunks, etc. We can all imagine what that was like for an Army life, where it's like you get out of your bunk, you go do PT, and then you start your day. Well, General May said, this is not the way the SAC operates. We are a 24/7 operation, and I don't mean somebody coming into a bunk, you know, waking the next guy up who's trying to sleep to go on his third shift, etc. So he starts the DORN system under Strategic Air Command, and it's the system that's still in existence today in our Air Force, where airmen live in dorms versus, you know, barracks, because of the fact that General May said the 24/7 operation needs a place where airmen can get rest because they could be going on shift, you know, all night long. So, again, these are things I will say that were interesting. And when I did the research, didn't understand the origins of all these things that we still see in existence on our bases today.
Hmm. And this isn't meant to be a joke, but the golf courses on Air Force bases, SAC wasn't involved in setting that up for the, you know, for morale, was he?
No, I will say that General LeMay was, I don't know how much of a golf enthusiast he was. I mean, there may be pictures of him playing golf. He wasn't as big on that. He was very big on, obviously, shooting, auto hobbies. His thing, too, was another thing that he did for the reason he started auto hobby shops or working on cars is he said, look, when people at West Point, right, his idea was when you go to look at people at West Point, every West Point officer had a horse. That was their thing, right? They had horses, and he was like, but we're pilots. We don't have horses. We have sports cars. So this is one of the things that he, you know, that leads him into doing this auto hobby shop thing is that he's like, hey, we pilots. We drive sports cars. We don't drive horses.
Yeah, fast things. They want things that go
exactly.
Fast. So what part of the research was the most enjoyable?
I would say really going out and talking to those who were in Strategic Air Command at the time, who were just, you want to get the ground truth. I understand what General May was trying to do. Was he this guy, you know, we always hear this, these mantras of to err is as human, to forgive is not fact policy, right? These are things of which, you know, it makes it seem like General May was someone who was very hard, and he was very driven, and who would not accept mistakes. And so when he talked to the crew force, they really respected General May. The crew force really believed in what he was trying to do and think he was a great leader. They also have an affinity for all things Boeing. I mean, when I go to I went to some of these SAC reunions, right? So the KC-135, which was a Boeing aircraft, 707 is the tanker that's still flying today. The B-52 is a Boeing aircraft, and I'm not here to promote Boeing. I'm just saying the B-52 is a Boeing aircraft that's been flying since, you know, the 1950s and programmed to fly for maybe another 50 years or so.
Mm-hmm.
And so their mantra is, if it isn't Boeing, I ain't going, right? So they're, because they understood, you know, the aircraft that SAC primarily flew and that did the job for during the Cold War and continue to do the job today. So, I mean, it's just those kinds of things where you meet people who are out there actually doing the mission. Now, at the same token, it's not to say it was all rosy and unicorns and rainbows out there working for Strategic Air Command. The competition was high, the stress level was high, and in fact did have the highest divorce rate of any of the major commands in the Air Force.
Oh.
Because of the fact that the people were driven to do this operation 24/7.
So what did you find that was most surprising in your research?
I think I mean, other than the origins of the things I already told you about, you know, the arrow clubs and the gun clubs and the hobby shops, I will say that the other aspect of it that was surprising really was the fact that most of what General Levine did, in fact, was foundational for what he was doing in World War II. For example, in World War II, and even in the Air Force today, we have this mentality of, hey, let's take a high-time pilot and put in with the low-time co-pilot to kind of even out the experience and to make the people, you know, to make that experience even out so that the high-time pilot can train that co-pilot. We'll put the high-time co-pilot with the brand-new AC so that there's somebody there to check the brand-new aircraft commander.
Mm-hmm.
General May was very big on, he said, stop that. He's like, when you get people who work well together as a team, keep them together as a team. And so he developed the idea of hard crews in World War II. That translated into facts. So I'm in my research talking to people. I met a guy who was on a B-47 crew, which is three people. That crew moved from base to base as a crew. So, you know, they were all three transferred to the same base as a crew, and they flew together for 7 years as a crew. The same three people for 7 years flew every mission together. And it's, you will not find that in today's Air Force. And it's just amazing is the, you know, the fact that they worked well together and kept them together as a crew for 7 years. The other thing that General May did was, again, standard operating procedures. That was something that was foundational in World War II, as well as the idea of what he did. He had lead crews, and in World War II, that meant that a bombardier would study a certain target area, and then he would lead that mission when called upon to that target area, and that became the basis for what we have today in the Air Force called standardization and evaluation crews, the crews that are the best of the best to evaluate the rest of the fleet.
Mm-hmm. So what was the most difficult part or difficult thing to research?
I would say the most difficult thing to research is trying to stay unclassified. That's the key aspect, right?
Mm-hmm.
The more classified, if you, there is no classified in the book, but if you, you know, if you try to do a classified dissertation or classified research, then you limit the access of people to read it. And so I wanted to stay unclassified primarily because I want to get the story out so people can understand why it was that Strategic Air Command operated differently than all of the other commands, especially during the Cold War, the initial phases of the Cold War.
Okay. Was there anything you discovered that emotionally moved you in some way, and that could either be sadness or something that you found really funny or made you really happy?
I would say the funny, so in other words, the funny stuff or the humorous stuff is the some of the myth that goes with General LeMay. So he obviously is a big person, an influential person when it comes to Strategic Air Command, but there are these stories that come up around General LeMay, whether it's the story of him holding this, you know, supposed saboteur in his office at gunpoint. There's another story of somebody who broke onto a base and this airman shot twice in order to stop the saboteur and supposedly killed him. And General LeMay said, right, General LeMay said, I want 50 cents for the bullet that you didn't, that missed, right? So these are apocryphal stories, but at the same token, they kind of demonstrate the myth of General LeMay.
So what do you hope this book will do for the field of either Air Force history or military history in general?
I think when we look at, right, so when we look at Strategic Air Command, what we want to say is this was a force that, this was a command dedicated to building a deterrent force. And deterrence, whether it's in 1948 or whether it's in 2018, we can learn from what they did to create that deterrent force and still keep some of those same principles in our force today. The idea of using realistic training and no-notice inspections and competition as a way to hone a force in being that's ready to do the mission at a moment's notice. So that is part of it. It's also how Strategic Air Command, right, evolves over time. Whatever deterrent force we have today will not be the same deterrent force 20 or 30 years from now, because it will have to evolve as the political situation, the strategic situation evolves. For example, in Strategic Air Command, initially it was a force of bombers that were take off, fly to another site, get their weapon, and then deploy from there. Sputnik changes that. Strategic Air Command has to adapt to the ICBM age, right? So they have to go from this idea of flying to another base, getting your weapon, and then deploying to, hey, we got to be ready to go in 15 minutes. So whatever strategic environment changes happen between now and 20 years from now, Air Force Global Strike Command will have to adapt to that, and they can learn from what SAC did in 57.
Can you speak to any difficulties you had in getting the book published and how you overcame those?
I think I will just say this. I will give a shout-out to Paul Springer, who's the editor of the series. He did a lot of work helping me get the book published. I would just say that, you know, for anybody who wants to publish, right, you have to wear your ego on your sleeve. If somebody rejects your book or tells you your book's not the right book for that series, et cetera, you have to wear your ego on your sleeve. You can't take it personally.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just based upon the, you know, what the publishers want at that time, what the editor wants at that time, et cetera. But at the same token, you know, I completed my degree in 2007, the dissertation was completed in 2007. It's taken about 10 years, and that's because I was on active duty, for 7 of those years, and it's very hard when you're sitting in Iraq or et cetera to work on a manuscript. At the same token, right, and life gets in the way, et cetera. It's a labor of love, so don't, you know, you got to see it through fruition. Wear your ego on your sleeve or your, you know, have thin skin, and, you know, continue the process.
So do you have another writing project going on or coming up?
So I will say that my desire would be to do the second part of Strategic Air Command. Strategic Air Command was very good at what they did in 1962. You take a pilot who is trained to fly the line, who's trained to be on time, on target, who's told not to deviate, because if he deviates left or right, he could run into frag from other nuclear weapons going off on his mission. So he's got to stay on the line, on time, on target. You take that same pilot, you put him over Hanoi in 1972, with SA-2s being shot at him, and you lose these refugees in combat because they're not maneuvering and they're getting shot at and they're getting blown out of the sky.
Mm-hmm.
From that, SAC has to now adapt, right, to a new conventional environment and has to understand that their crews have to be not just nuclear trained, but conventional as well. What today we call dual-capable aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
So bombers are now capable of doing nuclear missions and conventional missions. SAC creates the SAC Weapons and Tactics School in Ellsworth, South Dakota, where they basically take crews there and train them in low level, in maneuvering, in how to do combat tactics at the conventional level and somewhat at the nuclear level, but primarily for the conventional mission. And so we're training these guys, and then we send them out the red flag where they integrate with fighters, other assets in composite packages. All of that leads to, you know, on the first night of Desert Storm, we have B-52s going in low level over Saddam Hussein's IADs, dropping cluster bombs and runway cutters and et cetera, throughout, Saddam Hussein's, target complex there,
mm-hmm.
that are successful. And so it's this idea of you take this Strategic Air Command and you have to change the culture again a little bit to say, hey, now we have to do this conventional mission, and they're able to do it when it comes to the Gulf War.
Right. So I had to ask you, I saw that you flew a record-breaking 44.3-hour mission. I'm just curious, why did, if you can speak to it, you know, that's, did you just not want to come down?
I'll be glad to. So I was fortunate enough, after 9/11, we knew that there would be a response for what had happened to the World Trade Center, to the Pentagon, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
We knew that there was going to be a response, and so we identified crews at Wyman Air Force Base for the first three nights of whatever operation we had planned, and we didn't know what that operation was going to be when we identified crews. Myself and he's now Colonel Brian Neal, he's a Viking commander in Florida in the reserve, were paired together, and we trained in simulators, and we practiced our procedures until we were told, hey, you guys are up, go fly your mission. So we flew on the second night of operations over Afghanistan, Operation Enduring Freedom.
Mm-hmm.
The reason the missions were so long is that we went across the Pacific the long way because of strategic concerns with going through the Mediterranean and over the Middle East. A decision was made to go across the Pacific. So we flew from Missouri, got our first air refueling off the coast of California, went to Hawaii, got an air refueling there, went to Guam, got an air refueling there, and then went through the Straits of Malacca, got an air refueling there. The primary reason was that was the quickest way in the shortest amount of time to set up a tanker bridge. The B-2 is a long-duration bomber, but it still needs gas every so often. So after the Straits of Malacca, we went by Diego Garcia, where we got our last air refueling. And then we went up the coast of India into Afghanistan. Why was ours so long? Is we did our target complexes in Afghanistan. We came out. We still had weapons on our aircraft. We were told to go back and strike that target complex. So we got air refueling from a reliability tanker. That's just a tanker that's out there in case somebody needs gas. We went and found this tanker, got topped off. Went back into country, did one more target complex, came out of the country where we hit our last tanker, and from there we went to, from that tanker, we got enough fuel to get us to Diego Garcia. When we got to Diego Garcia, it's 44.3 hours because as we make our final approach into Diego Garcia, there's a B-52 in front of us that has an emergency, and we're on short final, and they're like, D2 on short final, go around, and we're like, really? We've been airborne 44 hours. So we need to go around, and that's why it's 44.3 hours, because we have to do a go around the pattern one more time in order to do this B-52 time to taxi off.
Note, I lost my phone connection with Dr. Daly at this point in the interview, and once we reestablished it, he restarted the ending of his story.
So we're on short final, we get sent around, and that's why the mission is 44.3 hours.
Mm-hmm.
When we land at Diego Garcia, they come out, and while the engines are running, they put oil on the aircraft, because that's really the limiting thing on the B-2s, how long they'd be airborne without oil. So they put oil on the aircraft, a fresh crew gets on, and they take off, hit a tanker, and then they fly 30 hours back. So the B-2 itself, six aircraft, flew 70 hours over 3 days, and, you know, not one of them broke. So that's, again, a testament to Northrop Grumman for their design of the B-2.
Yeah. Nice. Thank you for telling me that. Now, where can people find your latest book and your, you know, any other work?
For right now, the book is, you can pre-order the book on Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
It's available through them, or it's available through Naval Institute Press, who's the publisher of the book. So Amazon, it's Always at War, and Mel Dealey, D-E-A-I-L-E. You can find that book on Amazon or through Naval Institute Press. At the same token, you can also, find me on LinkedIn or Facebook if you want a signed copy, and just direct message me and say, hey, I'd like a signed copy, and I can do that as well. In the future, this summer, I will take over we have a school of advanced nuclear and deterrence studies that's in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Mm-hmm. And that school is moving from Albuquerque, New Mexico to Maxwell Air Force Base to be under Air Command and Staff College. And the program will be there, and we'll start publishing more things related to deterrence and nuclear studies as well once we become the School of Advanced Air and School of Advanced Nuclear and Deterrence Studies.
Hmm. Okay. That's all the questions I have. Do you have any final thoughts or comments?
I just want to thank you for your time, Chris, and I hope people enjoyed the interview.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for listening. More information can be found at warscholar.org.